Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and today we're continuing to talk about the budget 2021 analysis, critique, and trying to really go through what impact did it have on inequality and poverty. And we're also going to talk about COVID and how the pandemic, the recession is impacting our most vulnerable. And joined with me today, I'm delighted to have Tricia Keelty, Head of Social Justice and Policy at the St. Vincent de Paul and Adjunct Assistant Professor at UCD, and Eamon Murphy, Economic and Social Analyst with Social Justice Ireland. And I'd encourage listeners and remind you all again, please sign up, become a patron to tortoiseshack.ie. Go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and you can become a patron and support us to keep putting out these podcasts. Before we get on to the budget, Tricia Keelty, I was just asking you to think about there's been a lot of talk about, you know, the wider kind of economic impact of COVID, the recession, but I feel there's been a lack of depth of analysis or any sense, and maybe we don't fully understand. How is it impacting sort of people you're working with, those in poverty, in terms of what's happened over the last 6 months?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, if we go back to March and the types of calls we would have been getting when the first lockdown was announced, you know, a lot of people had been in low paid work and they lost their jobs and they had no income because they were waiting for social welfare payments to come through. So that was kind of, we had an initial spike in our calls at that time because, you know, people were worried about what was going to happen. And then also just, people, you know, we didn't really know, you know, would there be any issue in getting access to food? So we had a lot of calls around people who were worried about like food insecurity and things like that.
Yeah.
And I suppose then, you know, the speed at which the Department of Social Protection rolled out the pandemic unemployment payment, you know, that really helped in those initial few months. I suppose just then other issues started to come up. You know, we had a lot of calls from lone parents who, you know, were receiving child maintenance from the non-resident parent, but they had lost their job, so now they were down money. And we also had, you know, a lot of calls from people who, lone parents in particular, I know Louise talked about this as well, Louise Bayliss from Spark, you know, that being refused access to supermarkets because they had children with them and there was a concern around children being vectors. So, you know, supermarkets were banning entry and that was having a real big impact on lone parents in particular.
Yeah.
And then we had a lot of calls in relation to food because school meals initially didn't continue. So, you know, the extra cost of having to have the lunch ready and the breakfast clubs were gone and things like that, that really had an impact on households who are on very, very low incomes. And then really just people were, you know, people living alone, the level of isolation and you know, mental health issues for people who are really worried as well about the virus. And a lot of people, you know, who have underlying health conditions as well, you know, were worried about going out. They were totally cut off from their community and it was very, very difficult. And I think, you know, in the last number of months, now it's just shifted a little bit. So in the end of June, the moratorium on energy disconnections was lifted.
Yeah.
So people have started getting disconnection notices from their suppliers. So we have a big increase in calls from people who have utility debt. And I suppose the big issue is that usage was way up during the lockdown because people were at home more. And so now they have much bigger debt than they would have normally. And they are on a lower income maybe, or they have no prospect of going back to work anytime soon. So they're really worried about what will happen with that and how they'll, you know, that they may be disconnected. The other thing in the last 2 weeks, you know, from when the PUP payment was cut from 300 to 350, you know, I've had calls from people who said, that's my food budget gone, that €50. So I've nothing now. I'm really stuck. So we're getting those types of calls now. And then loads of calls from people, particularly people in HAP tenancies, who, because they had extra costs during the lockdown, they're in arrears on the HAP top-up. So, you know, the extra you pay to meet to the landlord to meet the market rent.
Yeah.
And they're not sure what will happen now in January when the protections are lifted, those limited protections for people who are in rent arrears. So a lot of anxiety, a lot of real basic difficulties. You know, food poverty really came to the fore during the crisis. And I think if we're going in and out of lockdown, you know, the same measures that applied in March should be applied again. So things like the eviction ban, the higher rate of pub payment, and making sure that people who are already in poverty, you know, haven't really seen any increase in their income as a result of the pandemic, even though they're faced with higher household costs as a result.
Just on the ending of the moratorium on disconnections of utilities, that hasn't got much attention in the media. And it seems particularly, obviously, those two things, both the moratorium on, you know, disconnections and the lifting of the banning on evictions have major health implications in the middle of a pandemic. They seem to be, you know, just again, like illogical from a public health perspective.
Absolutely. You know, we would have, you know, people, even the, it doesn't even make sense from a supplier point of view, because the cost of, you know, disconnecting and reconnecting and all that kind of thing just is huge, huge impact. And I think going into winter now, and people who maybe self-disconnecting is what we'd call, because they're trying to cut down on their bill, may increase as well, where people are just sitting in the cold or in the dark, and the impact that has on their physical and mental health can't be underestimated. And then the same with the eviction ban, you know, if, you know, we're told to stay at home, but people can be evicted from their homes, because it's important to remember that you can still be evicted on the grounds of sale, or that the landlord wants to have the property back for family use or something like that. So the protections that are in place are very weak, because you could be evicted on another basis. So, you know, it's really important that we put those protections back in now for hearing that level four or level five is a possibility.
Yeah, thanks for that, Tricia. Eamon Murphy from Social Justice Ireland, what's your kind of sense of the kind of the broader impact of inequality, of the COVID pandemic, the recession, on poverty and inequality in Ireland?
Well, I suppose it's cliched at this point to say some of these things, but like a lot of cliches are really worth repeating. What this pandemic has really done is highlighted a lot of inadequacies in our system that probably most people would have been unconsciously aware of, but now this has really shone a brighter light on, say, the it's highlighted the importance of a robust welfare system, of the importance of a well-funded healthcare system and other public services. It's brought a lot of attention on the inadequacy of poor welfare rates as well. I mean, the speed at which the government rushed to pay an increased welfare payment in the PUP to people who are losing their jobs goes to show that they were always aware that of the inadequacies of those payments. As well, as it's kind of highlighted the divides as well between those in stable employment, like myself, I must say, and those in precarious jobs, and kind of those in low paid work. So as regards for the implications for inequality and poverty, I would say that whereas this COVID has brought an entirely new context to things, and it's unprecedented in terms of social and economic upheaval that it's caused, COVID won't cause an increase in poverty and inequality. It's policy that does that. The policy levers are there to ensure that the situation that we had before the pandemic doesn't get exacerbated. And it's policy decisions that one way or the other decide what's going to happen in relation to that. And I guess in that regard, Budget 2021 was the first major opportunity for the government to show what they plan on doing about that kind of thing.
I think I was quite struck there by what you said. Would you agree with that, Tricia, in terms of kind of Eamon's analysis and framing of it there, that, you know, it's not COVID that has caused this and the pandemic, it's policy decisions that's caused kind of this rise, you know, the increased calls you're seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose if we had effectively dealt with some of the issues, you know, the inadequacy of social welfare, making sure that our public services are accessible for those who need it, and making sure that people weren't in a situation where they're in low paid precarious work, it would have been much easier to navigate this pandemic if we had a strong welfare system that supported people through more difficult times.
Yeah, no, it's something that, like, I was tweeting today about my 5-year-old, my poor 5-year-old, who I had to say he couldn't have a play date today, or go into his neighbor's friend's house. And he literally started roaring, crying, like going, just like, this is just so wrong. I hate the corona. And, you know, in my heart, you know, obviously that's, it's mild in comparison to what people are dealing with. But it's still, you know, it does show the impact of all this on people, you know, and particularly children, and how, and in my head going, this would not be as bad if we had a properly funded public health system. Because a lot of the panic, and it is panic and fear people have, is because, you know, we don't have the ICU capacity. We don't have that broader health capacity. And it seems that, you know, we are paying for that failure of policy over decades and decades. What do you think, Eamon?
I think that's a fair comment. And in some ways, that's why Budget 2021 is so disappointing in some respects. There was an opportunity here to address some of the challenges, address some of the deficits that we faced, close some of the gaps. And yet the ring-fenced funding for Sláinte Care, for example, that we've been calling for the last 4 budgets. And let's not forget that Sláinte Care, that report is sitting on the shelf since 2017. The ring-fenced funding for that infrastructure has still not been included in Budget 2021, despite the increase in capital spending and the much lauded expansionary budget that we've had. You'd like to think that certain lessons have been learned from this, and where it does look like this particular government has learned some of the, we'll call it the macroeconomic lessons from our previous recession, it seems that the impetus to narrow the deficits in services that Irish people face compared to our European counterparts was not necessarily there in this particular budget. There was an opportunity, and you had Tom McDonnell on here about a week ago talking about maybe grasping this opportunity to borrow at the extremely low rates that Ireland's capable of doing in order to contribute to a sovereign wealth fund and to lock in that really cheap borrowing in order to have the money there that we could use over the next 5 to 10 years to invest in our public services and social infrastructure, and leave us in a far better situation regard the things that we're talking about in a few years' time. That didn't happen in this particular budget, although generally speaking, we are quite happy with the fiscal stance, and we'll get onto that later, I'm sure. But it's kind of regrettable that you would imagine that a lot of the lessons that were there to be learned have not been, at least not been acted upon yet.
Yeah, I think, and we'll move on to that now in terms of both of your organizations and obviously your own, you're part of the organizations and leading the policy analysis within them, of the budget, your perspective on the budget. And I know just maybe first in terms of Eamon, you could bring us through Social Justice Ireland, your organization that you work for, has produced a Budget 21 analysis and critique, which you produce every year, and it's absolutely fantastic. And I would really encourage people to go on to your website and have a read through it. And the detail and statistics and facts in it are absolutely really just, I think, very, very useful and powerful. And you break down in terms of going through the budget, and policy wonks like myself get so excited when we see something so, like, in 24 pages, you've analysed the entire economy and society. It's just brilliant. And everyone else switches off as quick as they can. But for those who still listen, and of course, the point of what we're trying to do here is actually break those 24 pages down into about 3 minutes, which I'm sure you'll do really, really well, Eamon. The point you make, and, you know, there's a huge amount of analysis in it, is in terms of leaving the poorest behind. But maybe you could take us through kind of a couple of your kind of key findings from your analysis of the budget and what you present in your critique.
Well, from the point of view of not wanting to be overly negative and slamming the government on everything, because there's a lot of missed opportunities in this budget, I'll begin with something positive and say, you know, credit where it's due. I really feel like they got the fiscal stance right here, which is really important for any budget, but particularly this one, given the context of it. You know, the question was, would the government try to minimize the deficit in this particular budget which has been the orthodoxy whenever an Irish government has been faced with constrained public finances. But they did what every sensible commentator and group was advising them to, and they gave sort of a counter-cyclical boost to the economy and to the society that economy serves. So, and for all the talk about how this was by far the biggest budget in the state's history, and it definitely was, it was absolutely the appropriate thing to do. There's a couple of aspects I'd quibble with and how they did it, but it is a counter-cyclical budget, which we very strongly welcome. And it shows that they were not making the mistakes of 12 years ago when the economy was crying out for a boost, and yet the prevailing orthodoxy was spending cuts and austerity. I think actions that really kind of destroyed public services did a huge amount of damage to the most vulnerable, and essentially produced far higher unemployment than would have been necessary. But, you know, as I said, there was opportunities missed in this. And I'd imagine that Tricia feels similarly to me in this regard, that one of the biggest disappointments in this budget was the fact that government for the second year in a row did nothing to improve or to increase core welfare rates. There were some targeted increases in the living alone allowance, the qualified child allowance, which were very welcome. But core rates were ignored for the second year in a row. And we know at this stage, or at least policymakers know at this stage, that unless welfare rates keep pace with earnings growth in the economy, the most vulnerable in society get left behind. Earnings have been growing impressively the last few years. In the last 4 years alone, they've gone up by 16%. So in advance of Budget 2021, Social Justice Ireland was calling on the government to commit to benchmarking core welfare rates at 27.5% of average weekly earnings, and then to eventually move that in the direction of the MESL, or Minimum Essential Standard of Living rate. The fact that they've left this at the same rate of €203 a week for a second year in a row is very disappointing, because it means that you're guaranteed an increase in, or almost guaranteed, as close to guaranteed as I could say as possible, an increase in poverty rates in 2020 and in 2021, down to the fact that the budgets in those years did nothing to improve the lot of the most vulnerable. So TDs are getting an extra 40 quid or so a week in 2021. There's increments for civil servants that have come in October. The private sector has seen earnings growth in almost all sectors, and some very strong growth in some of those sectors. So it's really only people who are dependent on welfare that have gotten no improvement in their relative living conditions over the last couple of years. I think that's very regrettable.
And in terms of the other areas that you've looked at, I think that, you know, you described that the macro kind of fiscal stance as being correct. And I think that the macroeconomic and fiscal stance as being correct in response to that. I think that, you know, and again, Tom MacDonald from NERI made this point that and Aidan Regan also from UCD, that while, yes, they didn't go to, you know, be focused on in terms of the deficit reduction at this point, it's clear within all the talk and that the intention is that to try and stop this as quickly as possible in terms of this broad fiscal response. There's no long term. And as you say, that links into the health investment. There's no longer term plan, even 5 year plan, that we're going to continue to borrow to invest and respond.
Yeah, and I know I mentioned already the idea of funding a sovereign wealth fund with this cheap money, which was sort of ignored. I think something that happened or didn't happen in Budget 2021 that's kind of escaped a lot of people's attention is what went on with regard to the rainy day fund. Now, ostensibly, it's a very, very rainy day, and it might seem to make sense to withdraw that money and ensure that slightly less money needs to be borrowed. But you're talking about €1.5 billion there that was sitting, earning a nice return for itself. And instead, what the government has decided to do is that rather than borrow money at less than 0.5% in order to fund the necessary public spending in 2021, they've chosen to use that rainy day fund. It sort of smacks of, I know I said that there seemed to have been lessons learned and that the prevailing orthodoxy of the past wasn't quite as strong. But, you know, in that regard, the government showed that they haven't moved on that much, I guess. And that's sort of disappointing as well. It would make you worry for what's going to happen in, say, 2022. I think the government they've bought into this idea at least for the next 18 months or so, they should be pursuing this particular pathway. But you'd wonder, where's the 5-year plan for this? What's the end game, I guess?
And Tricia, just on the area of welfare, core welfare, in terms of your own analysis, and I read from your own press release there you put out, you said, you know, and we talked about at the start here, you know, the real impact of, you know, growth and poverty over the period of the last 6 months, that you're saying calls to you, to the St. Vincent de Paul, were up 15% in September. You know, that you would have thought that there would have been an increase in those core welfare rates across the board to try and help people respond to the clear increased cost, the, you know, collapse in any form of income coming into people's houses in terms of low wages in particular.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, the focus was really on COVID related supports, which are absolutely vital, and maintaining, you know, ensuring that they could sustain the pandemic unemployment payment. Which is really important. So I suppose you can't underestimate that, but it was kind of at this left little scope then for poverty reduction measures, particularly in the area of core social welfare rates. And the increase in the living alone allowance and the increase in the qualified child payment are really important. But I suppose if you look at it and break it down for what it actually means for people who are already struggling. So, for example, if you're a lone parent with two children under the age of 12, you'll get €4 extra a week in the budget. And you may also get extra in the fuel allowance. Still really important. But if you look at the next game, I suppose, as Eamon mentioned, you know, one, you have to look at what will happen to wages and will that open up the gap between those on high incomes and those on low incomes. It probably will, and we will see an increase in poverty rates. But the second is just what happens to prices. So next year, if inflation is predicted to go up by 0.2%, but that's probably very conservative, because if there's a no deal Brexit, the cost of basics, which people on low income spend a much higher proportion of their income, will increase significantly. So we're thinking about the cost of food and the cost of energy. And I think what was interesting is how the social welfare increases were positioned this year. The carbon tax actually ring-fenced 30% of the carbon tax revenue for social welfare increases. And that's, you know, obviously better than not doing that. But we wrote to the Department of Finance 2 years ago. They were doing a consultation on the carbon tax. And in it, we said we would be very concerned that if the social protection system was used to offset carbon tax increases, that it would end up that you would ignore or not have sufficient evidence or emphasis on other policy goals like improving income adequacy. So what has happened now is that people in poverty would have a slight, some people in poverty, not everybody in poverty, particularly single adults, have no increase, will have a slight increase in their income, but that's all automatically wiped out by the carbon tax increase and the increase in the public service levy, which is about €50 extra on your utility bill next year. So it's almost completely wiped out. So people who are on a low income, their life will be pretty much the same next year, or possibly worse, unfortunately.
That is, you know, it's a very stark analysis, and it's one that didn't come through in the broad public debate, the media debate around the budget.
Yeah, and I suppose we... you know, we've just put a document up on our website, and it actually just takes four cases of people that have sought help from SVP in the last year and just looking at what it actually means for them. So because life isn't straightforward, you know, you see, you know, the €4 increase, and you can look at it in a distribution analysis, and you can look at it in terms of what it means for different income quintiles. But when you drill down and actually look at people's lives and what it really means, for people who may have a big money lending debt, like the increase could be taken up with the interest you're paying alone on the money lending debt. Or one thing that happens every year, social welfare increases. And then if you're in HAP or you're in social housing, your rent increases. So automatically then you may have lost net income as well. And, you know, like it's very hard to get out of the poverty trap unless there is sustained investment in public services. So, for example, I think there's nothing in the budget for a rural transport program. I couldn't find anything. That's absolutely vital, you know, particularly low-income families who are working in low-paid work get very little in this budget because they don't qualify for the fuel allowance. There's been no investment in public transport, rural transport, sorry, should I say. And then the other area, education, school costs, literally nothing there to address the issue of school costs that cause so much stress and strain for parents every year, that may result in children disengaging because they don't have the right materials to learn. They feel different from their peers. Very little for educational disadvantage. You know, that really came to the fore during the pandemic. Children who couldn't keep up with their work, really high rates of disengagement from disadvantaged students over the lockdown. And it would have been really important that there was a dedicated fund to make up for any learning loss that would have been experienced over those couple of months. But there's nothing really there in the budget for that either. So, yeah, I suppose the reality is life won't change at all, really, for people who are in poverty, and the struggle to make ends meet will continue next year.
No, and again, it just, you know, it seemed to me it was quite, you know, I was shouting at the telly when, you know, on prime time they were asking, you know, every opening questioning was, you know, this has been the biggest spending budget ever. And, you know, how do you justify this biggest spending budget ever? And you're going, like, it's just such the wrong starting point. And you know, there was such a almost shallow level of analysis, and it was so frustrating. And one of the areas that I was actually quite shocked about, because it doesn't just affect people in poverty, but affects people across society, is the area of childcare. Tricia, why do you think they did absolutely nothing on childcare?
It was really shocking, because, you know, again, something that came to the fore during the pandemic was how vital childcare is for our society, how vital childcare workers are and how important they are in terms of the overall economy and society and for children. So I think it was quite surprising that there was nothing there in the budget for childcare. And, you know, from our perspective, you know, the National Childcare Scheme, you know, has disadvantaged the lowest income households most significantly. And we thought, you know, that would be a very simple change that they could introduce to make sure that the subsidies are adequate for people on the lowest incomes. But I don't think there's anything there in that regard either.
Yeah, thanks, Tricia. Eamon, the area you started referring to it earlier, in terms of health, and obviously there was a significant, you know, 2 billion increase in funding for health. But you make the point that there wasn't this ring fencing for Sláintecare care. Could you maybe expand on that? Because, the general portrayal in their sort of analysis in the media was, you know, this was fantastic for health. And obviously, you know, everybody started by saying, yes, we absolutely welcome this increase in health spending. But was it transformative, or, like, you know, or how does it actually fare in terms of an increase, or what should have been done?
Well, transformative it was not, but there were some big positives in there. I think primarily of the increase in the number of home care hours. There's an extra 5 million a year. I think that that brings it up to 19 million, which is a 5 million hours, I should say, of home care, bringing up to 19 million, which is a big increase. There's an extra 150 million in there for primary care, and that's something that both Social Justice Ireland and the Sláintecare report would advocate should be where the health system is moving, that we're too hospital-centric a health system in Ireland. But most of the additional funding that's going into health is going in to deal with the inevitable challenges that are coming down the track due to this pandemic. So from the base that we're starting at, we're not going to see very significant improvements in the healthcare system as a result of that. I suppose it's a problem that we saw in not just in healthcare, but in other service areas as well, education being one of them. So there were some positives in relation to the additional funding for SNAs and teachers, and for the intention to lower the pupil-teacher ratio, although it should still be pointed out we've got one of the highest in the EU. But again, I suppose, whereas, as you say, it was an expansionary budget and maybe too much attention is being paid for that. It's expansionary to deal with, it's a reactionary budget, I suppose, rather than proactively looking to invest to improve services in those areas. We're now looking at maintaining what we had, plus with the additional costs that's going to come as a result of COVID-19. I guess when the government was talking about the need for a new social contract and painting a vision for a society that we'd all like to live in, we maybe our expectations got a little bit out of hand, but for the time being at least, I do get that these are difficult circumstances, for the time being at least, it does seem like more of the same in a lot of respects. And I suppose I was also disheartened a little bit to see, when I talk about more of the same, I was disheartened to see the return of the VAT break for the hospitality sector. Admittedly, a little more positively in this regard, it's time limited this time, so we mightn't see it going on indefinitely. But I really think that while supports for businesses who are affected by this crisis are extremely important, they need to be better targeted, and this kind of blunt instrument of a VAT cut across an entire industry. What's going to happen now for the next 14 months or so is going to be the same as what happened while this was going on throughout the early part of the last decade, and that is the largest players in the accommodation and food and hospitality sectors are going to corral the majority of that benefit. Fact is that like what most businesses need is cash, not reduced VAT. It's not as if sales aren't happening because prices aren't competitive. It's because people can't or won't go out and risk catching a virus that might kill them. So this is using sort of the demand side response to tackle a supply issue. And I suppose speaking of demand side responses to supply issues, they've maintained the Help to Buy scheme as well, which was another huge disappointment for us. Even though the evidence is suggesting that, and this was reiterated actually this morning by Barra Rowntree of the SRI at their budget response earlier today, a substantial proportion of that money is going to go to people who already had the deposit. They don't need it. It's the majority of the money is going to people in kind of the upper part of the income distribution. And given that government must know at this stage, I can only assume that the purpose of this policy being maintained is to make the direct recipients of the program feel like they're getting something from the government. But the longer term implication for the housing market is that developers now know that buyers have an extra few tens of thousands of euros in their pocket that they otherwise wouldn't have, and developers can now factor in that in the asking price, and it's simply going to serve to lock in higher prices for the long term. It's sort of I almost regret saying at the beginning of the podcast now, Rory, that the economic orthodoxy of the past is changing, because in some regards it's not changing at all. It's sort of still very much a market-driven response to the challenges we face. That's not to water down the big positives in this budget, but in a lot of regards it is sort of more of the same.
Yeah, I think that is actually an issue around the budget, which is the largest spending budget. But as I made the point on the night, our analysis, this is also, we are dealing with a decade of austerity, of cuts that happened to our public services that has to be made up, population growth, along with you could say whatever 40 years of never developing proper public services. So the starting point of saying, oh, this is great, this is an increase, our starting point is so low that I think there was a real lack of depth to the analysis presented in the media of the budget, and how significant it was. It was like just looking at the headline figures, that's an increase, and not actually looking at the longer term kind of where we're coming from. And in terms of the one area, is there was a couple of areas that you highlighted in the year analysis, Eamon. The disability, I was struck by, you said there was no progress around disability.
Yeah, and I suppose maybe that should have been nuanced a bit to take into account the additional spending in regards to disability supports in relation to COVID. But again, I suppose we would say that was just to ensure that the situation for people with disabilities within the health system gets maintained at where it was. If you wanted to see progress for people with disabilities, the first thing we would say is that you need to acknowledge that living with a disability brings about additional costs purely as a result of having that disability, and acknowledge that by bringing in a cost of disability allowance. And Social Justice Ireland has been advocating for this for years. We believe you could start off something quite small, say 20 euros a week. And, we believe, of course, in evidence-based policy. So, there's been reports commissioned on this before. We wouldn't be averse to seeing another one to establish what is the additional cost of having a disability. But that was sort of the main headline for us in relation to the for people in that particular situation, that, you know, there was no acknowledgement of the additional costs that they suffer. And we must remember that the group that consistently suffers the highest levels of poverty in our society are those of people who cannot work due to having an illness or a disability. And these aren't people, their prospects for escaping that poverty trap are so much reduced compared to the rest of society as well. So, you know, I guess there are another group that sort of got ignored. And you're right, really, when you talk about the depth of the analysis that goes on in relation to this budget, because you'd love to see somebody on RTE frame a question in terms of how are we doing in this area compared to our peer countries of Western Europe, compared to the Benelux countries, France, Germany, Austria, Scandinavian countries. How do we compare in relation to healthcare compared to them, in relation to our education system and pupil-teacher ratios? We're looking at a baseline. We're always looking at how we've done in the past or are doing now. Frankly, that's not good enough. We've got a huge deficit in our public services and our social infrastructure compared to what the European norm is. And really, the only way to close that gap is to spend money, is to invest over the long term. Now, we were delighted to see an increase in capital expenditure in this particular budget, which kind of highlighted the fact that at least government realizes there's a need for that. But again, I go back to this idea that we could have borrowed an awful lot more given the prevailing cost of borrowing for Ireland. And there seemed to be a reluctance to do that. I don't know whether that was the government worried that the system wouldn't be able to absorb it. I know there's concerns around the construction sector in relation to that. But, you know, we're at a situation now where, like, there's four, from my point of view, there's four key things happening. The first is that, like, interest rates are so low that the borrowing costs for Ireland is negligible. Second is that unemployment is really high and we're in the middle of an economic contraction. The third is that we've got, as I mentioned just a moment ago, these significant deficits in our public services and social infrastructure. And the fourth is that there's a clear need for us to restructure our economy towards a more green, more sustainable model, and to ensure that that transition is carried out in a just and fair way. So with those four things happening at the moment, there can never, and I do emphasize never, be a better time to borrow cheap money to invest, to improve capital investment in this country. I'm hoping that this budget is not a sign that this government is going to miss a trick on that one, because, you know, we may never have an opportunity like this again, frankly. You've got not just that cheap borrowing, but there's a real desire, I think, within Irish people for a new paradigm, a new way of doing things. We've got the relaxation of the Stability and Growth Pact from the EU. It's like it's a perfect storm of opportunity for us. And maybe this, I think Budget 2021 might have been a little bit too conservative in that regard.
That's great, Eamon Murphy from Social Justice Ireland. I think that's a really good summation. Tricia, just to finish up, in terms of, you know, where you see this going, how do you see things panning out now over the next kind of year? And how does St. Vincent de Paul kind of take the approach of, you know, the government? How do you, like, do you lobby the government? do they respond to your analysis? Or how do you engage with them to try and pressure this change, you know, the changes that are needed over the coming months and years?
I suppose just in response to the first question, I suppose it depends on, you know, the decisions that are made in the next coming weeks. You know, if we go back into level four, level five kind of level lockdown, you know, we'll have to see the eviction ban come back in and the moratorium on disconnections, because if people are at risk and there's a public health crisis, you know, that has to be, there needs to be protections there. The next piece, I think, is the issue of mounting household debt. So we may need to see a debt relief mechanism both for utility arrears and also for rent arrears, because even if people can access rent supplement or work out a payment plan, if the rent arrears are allowed to accrue and there's no mechanism to deal with that, then you're going to see a big surge in evictions if eviction ban is lifted fully. I think also, just in terms of income supports, you know, again, those increases that we'll see from January onwards are really important. You know, it's obviously better than having no increases in those important payments like the qualified child and the living alone allowance. But really what you're going to see now is a lot of people struggling because the impact of essentially a 2-year freeze on social welfare payments is going to see a higher level of people who are cutting back on basics to make ends meet. And I think we are going to see an increase in poverty and deprivation in 2021 and this year as well, unfortunately. In terms of how we engage with government, I suppose, you know, we do that in a number of ways. You know, we would engage through the community and voluntary pillar. We also try and we always, you know, make submissions, and we try and meet with policymakers and politicians just to ensure that, you know, the people that we're assisting, that their voice is heard, and that their needs are considered in policy making. And I think in some ways, you know, the issue of poverty has come more to the fore. I think it was significant that there was debate on child poverty in the Oireachtas 3 weeks ago, and the Social Democrats brought forward their motion on ending child poverty, which was unfortunately amended with a counter motion. But, you know, it was, I think I looked at the Oireachtas debate going back, and poverty hadn't been discussed at that level since 1996. Which is kind of astonishing, really.
That is shocking.
So there hadn't been a motion on poverty, nor child poverty since then. So again, it's going back to our kind of asks around the accountability and where poverty fits within the national agenda. So I suppose we'd love to see a joint Oireachtas committee set up specifically on poverty and inequality, just to oversee government policy in that regard. You know, I'm not entirely confident that our ask around having a legislation around a poverty act would actually be enacted or not. And then in Scotland, they have a poverty and inequality commission, which is an independent body who essentially holds the government to account on their commitments in relation to that. So that could be something that could work quite well in the Irish context. I think on social welfare, you know, we would like to see the political football taken out of the budget and how decisions are made about social welfare. So actually enacting a system where you're benchmarking social welfare rates against the cost of an MESL, and that's set out, like they've set out for the carbon tax, that the carbon tax will increase by €7.50 every year. Let's say now, just so that people have assurances over what their income will be and that it's adequate. So over the next 5 years, you're going to see an X increase in all social welfare rates with the proportionate increases for other payments as well. So people know exactly what their income will be. And again, the Christmas bonus, which is not the correct term for it, people only know if they have that or not in October. They could take the stress out of people's lives and just say, we're going to pay that. And that's just part of the social protection system as well. Because security and certainty are really important when you live in a life that you're living day to day and week to week.
Trisha Keelty, from St. Vincent de Paul, thank you so much. I think both of you, Eamon and Trisha, I really, you know, thank you for coming on today and outlining your analysis. I think that there's a depth to it that, you know, I haven't heard in the media, and really we need to try and get this, you know, this analysis out there, and that's what the idea of these podcasts are trying to do, this depth of analysis and focus on poverty and inequality and the broader structural issues. And I think you've set it out very, very well in terms of not just, you know, analysing the budget, but also broader, what kind of direction, as Eamon, you set out there, what direction society, you know, should go in if we want to address these issues. And I have to say, I was struck by a number of points that you made, Trisha, in terms of the kind of the increases then been wiped away straight away in things like rent or utility bills, and also the fact that we have disconnections going on around utilities, evictions going on at the height of a pandemic. It seems to me that, you know, policymakers really need to take Thomas Pringle TD's advice, listen to this podcast, and become a patron. Sign up patreon.com/ Tortoise Shack, support us and keep us going, and let's sort out these issues that really need to actually make a genuine republic of equality. Thank you so much.